so that they feel like the state of Oregon is providing a service which is fair and honest and is trying to do a decent job. That's what we try to do.
I agree with that, Mr. Morgan. The question is whether the place they should go is the existing structure of the Employment Appeals Board, and what, you know, I think the question is Representative Hanlon's been asking, and some of my concerns go along the lines as to whether the present structure of the board is one that is the most efficient, cost-effective way to handle these appeals. And so, you know, what we're just trying to, you know, elicit some information. We know that the board performs the function that has to be performed, and it's necessary for equity. But I guess I just appreciate receiving more information rather than just saying, well, we have this $850,000 budget that we really don't know, we really can't break down for you as to where it goes.
Well, good.
And we think that people are working more than full time, but less than, or more than half time, but less than full time, and that they make about $30,000 a year now. And you know, the kind of vague answers we've received from you don't give us the kind of information that's necessary to.
Mr. Chairman,
intelligent decision.
Ms. Leonard, I think you wanted to respond, and then we'll sort of see where we're going here.
On the issue of the budgeted amount and what the board members have made, I would come to Mr. Morgan's defense in that he doesn't keep the records of those. We do. We pay them, and I have Mr. Nairn out now calling to find out what each board member made last year. We have those records, and had I known they were germane to this issue, I would have brought them with me today. As far as a breakdown of the budget figure, what you have in front, or what Representative Hanlon has, is exactly what was presented in the state budget according to the state budget criteria of how the state budget is put together. I'm sure that there is some way to break out actual expenses that were accrued by the appeals board, for instance, in the last fiscal year. And there was also before Ways and Means subcommittee yesterday testimony that the appeals board will probably have a higher workload than we had anticipated, and therefore we requested that the budget document be amended to include a transfer of some funds from our regular unemployment insurance budget into the appeals board budget. Generally, it's a bottom-line budget anyway, under unemployment insurance, but the workload drives the budget. The budget includes a word processing system. The budget includes rent, premises, heat, lights, and so forth. Those can be broken out. That would take me quite a bit of time to do. But we'll have the figures for what the board members were paid in a few minutes.
Okay, well, just, Mr. Chairman, if I may, if one takes the budget you provided to us, which shows governor's recommended almost $600,000 for personal services, and if you take out compensation at the rate of $40,000 a year for three people on the board, which is approximately $20 an hour times 40 hours a week is, if you take $120,000 out of that, you end up with $480,000, basically, which is personal services for 4.75 positions.
All right.
Over a two-year period, or $240,000 per year for 4 or 5 positions, which is a rate of almost $50,000 a year for those
Mr.
positions.
Chairman.
I know there are fringes involved, but you know the cost of the current system seemed quite high, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Let me. I don't really know that we're prepared to do a mini Ways and Means number here on the Employment Appeals Board.
I can't believe what I'm hearing.
I want to let you folks.
And I make one statement that answered most of that question is that prior to about 9 months ago, the agency itself prepared the transcripts, which is a huge job. This last two-week set of transcripts weighed 62 pounds. I weighed them. A paper. We are now, the board is now providing its own transcripts and are having these typed up. And a big part of that increase is the cost of the transcripts, because the cost was transferred from the agency to the board, and that's where your big increase is. And that's why they asked for more money from Ways and Means. it counted somewhere like 8 or 9 positions when it was with the agency before.
Mr. Chairman, I would recommend that we get back on the bill.
I agree.
Okay, I want to, I guess, ask the folks who have expressed a concern so far, Representative Leek and Representative Hanlon, is it your desire that this matter be carried till this evening or till another work session if you're going to be proposing any amendments, or just can we proceed to a work session on the bill itself?
My desire, Mr. Chairman, would be to carry this until another work session, not this evening. I guess, and I don't want to get into a ways and means game here, but we do decide fiscal issues in here, and when, just because we're spending federal money doesn't mean it's not real money. And if there is a better way to, there have been some suggestions, there's a better way, a more efficient way to administer the system. I'd like to take the time to be sure that the current system is working efficiently. So I'd like to carry it over till another day.
I agree with Representative Leek.
Okay, well, I would appreciate, we will carry it over in light of that request. I would appreciate it if Representative Leek and Representative Hanlon, if you have some amendments or if you want to just lay out conceptually what you think is a better system. We don't have time at this point in the session, if you will, to I think devote a whole lot of hearing time to this kind of dialogue. And I would, I think, and other members would appreciate knowing if you do have some specific suggestions for improvement in the structure or the way that EAB is administered, I think we'd be glad to consider them. But we do have, we don't have a lot of time to thrash it out in work session now or for the balance of the session. And if you could let the proponents here have an opportunity to know what your concerns are, so they'd be better prepared to respond. I think that would be helpful to all of us.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
It appears Ms. Leonard may have the figures at present if you want to take them now.
No, I don't want to take them now because we've already spent, I think, 20 minutes off the bill and on the concept of the board, and I don't think members are really prepared to take or spend much more time on the issue now.
Chair, one quick
Representative Johnson.
I understand that Representative Leek and Representative Hanlon obviously have some kind of concern. Could you put it in writing so that the rest of the members understand where you're driving? Because that's the only way this thing gets to be useful, is to know what you're really trying to achieve.
Okay, I would second that motion, I guess. Okay, we'll be carrying 2908 over then, and we will inform you of the next work session date on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I would encourage you to contact those members of the committee who have expressed some concern or some questions about the overall function, and I'd invite them to also share with us, again, any proposals they may have. Okay, moving right along. Let's start with the bills that have been heard in an earlier hearing at work session, 2014, 2017, and 2933, relating to non-teacher school district employees dismissed only for just cause, community college employees, and fair dismissal law. I think those folks are out in the hall. We'll ask them to come on in.
Unless you want to take action today on it, apparently you're not.
2908?
Yeah.
That's correct. We'll carry it over for another work session.
Okay. Let's set it for Friday.
For Friday?
And let's get the job done.
Okay. Tell you what, we're probably going to offer an amendment that would call for adding a subject to the board.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Your sense.
Can you be ready by Friday? Okay, we'll be 2908. We'll be carrying over till Friday.
and we'll amend our agenda to so reflect that. Okay, Mr. Donnelly, Mr. Satchel, are you folks the sort of the negotiators here on 2014, 2017, and 2933? And Mr. Auerbach. Excuse me.
You want to include one?
Yep.
Okay, why don't you kind of tell us where we're at here and what bills you've been able to agree on and what's going to be the vehicle and all that good stuff.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Don Satchel, speaking on behalf of the Oregon Education Association. The labor organizations interested in this issue have met and worked out basically a compromise, part of which is contained in House Bill 2014, which is hand-dated 5-11-83, and a feeble attempt at hand-engrossing the bill.
Okay. Everybody have that in front of him or her. Okay, go ahead. Why don't you tell us what's going on?
Okay. In the original 2014, we have withdrawn out of that bill the bottom section on the page there, which dealt with the reduction of force. 2014 deals strictly with just cause and requires just cause for dismissal or demotion in an effort to try to approach some of the concerns of the Oregon School Boards Association with the vagueness of just cause. We have in the section there broken out the rules, which we find generally that the arbitrators have used in determining just cause in the private sector for the last couple of decades. So those A through G there are well tested, that court cases all the way up to the Supreme Court have determined exactly what they do mean. So they're very clear and concise as to what they mean. On the bottom, the addition added there is, in case there is not an agreement as to who the mutual agreement as who the arbitrator is, a system so that an arbitrator could be selected from a list of five appointed by the Employment Relation Board. I got it. On the second page, the additions there would clarify the procedure for the arbitrator, the arbitrator's right, payment of the arbitrator, and enforcement of the arbitration award.
First off,
Representative Johnson,
how many bills are encompassed in this thing?
Okay. This is 2014. The inserts come out of 2990.
Okay. Would every bit of this be bargainable?
No.
Okay. Okay, basically, if I understand what we're doing, there were a couple of concepts presented at the first work session. One had to do with the idea that the just cause, the other had to do with putting individuals who are not now afforded the opportunity to appear before the Employment Relations Board or the
Fair Employee Dismissal
Board, rather, would extend that coverage. Basically, the concept that you've agreed upon is the just cause concept rather than extending the fair dismissal safeguards, if you will, or procedure to another category of employees.
That is correct.
If I might address that for a moment.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr.
This is Jerry Donnelly from the Oregon School Employees Association. There were two issues involved, actually, in both bills. Both bills dealt with both dismissal and reduction in force issues. The associations had taken different approaches to dealing with both of those issues. OSCA had originally dealt with both of those issues through the mechanism of the fair dismissal law. And we have split those two issues, in effect. And the RIF provisions that were included in the initial Oregon Education Association requested Bill 2014 in regard to RIF have been removed. That's the paragraph on page one of the long hand engrossment that's been deleted. And that has now been made a part of the proposed amendments to 2933, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Okay.
And, but the parties, it is correct, the parties have come to the agreement to take the just cause and arbitration approach to the dismissal issue.
Can I ask
you,
Mr.
What's
yes,
the reason for the section related to a penalty for contempt? Is there any need for that at all? I just wondered what you were trying to reach to.
I think we would all answer that with a yes.
But there is that just the mere fact that court said it must be done would be sufficient. I can't picture any public entity refusing to obey the actions of a court. Has it ever happened?
Basically, yes, it has happened. And partly what occurs is just a prolonged delaying process before they will do it.
Isn't there a court remedy for failure to comply with with court's orders anyway?
Going back to court. Expensive process.
Okay, I just needed to understand what you're driving at.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Gold.
In response to Representative mm-hmm. Johnson's question as to the need, this is a different subject area, but as you asked it, it brought something to mind. For all the years that I've been involved in education, Portland School District and the Teachers Retirement Fund Association and the legislature and the PERS have been engaged in trying to combine the local retirement thing with the state. And there have been court orders and there have been legislative direction, and it's only now, some, I don't know how many years later, that it's about to come about. Now, that's a different subject area and all that, but with your question about wouldn't a public entity choose to comply, and
I guess I'm naive.
That's my example.
Okay.
Very okay. few. I can think of just a couple in the last 5 years, but
I admit being naive on that issue. Right now.
Okay, let me. I think there's a. Just we need to insert an article down in some of the new language on the first page down in subsection G where it says, the discharge in particular case. Should that read the discharge? In the particular case, that's pretty minor, but mm-hmm. Let me, as members review these, let me ask them if they have any questions of the three gentlemen before us, and then we'll certainly be asking Mr. Berger and anyone else to respond. Mr. Dudley probably wants to respond. Any questions at this time of the proponents? Okay. Why don't we just ask you to retire briefly to the front row, and let me throw it open to any questions, or let me see who signed up. No one signed up, and Mr. Dudley, I assume you may have a comment or two.
No. Now's the time.
Sure. Now or never.
Too late. I heard about these amendments yesterday. This is the first time I've seen them in the bill. And I believe what they do is put a fairly standard or liberal definition of what's what the components of just cause are in the statute. And I would relate to you that that is mandating in statute something that's currently...
You haven't identified yourself.
Chris Dudley, Oregon School Boards Association. Thank you, Representative Ford. Excuse me, you got the wrong sign in front of you.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, okay. We all look alike.
Just gold. Anyway, back to the issue. What you're doing here, if you insert this in statute, is you're putting in law a standard and a requirement which they have been unsuccessful in seeking at the bargaining table, which is an inappropriate thing for you to do. The statute on public employee collective bargaining makes it clear that in that relationship between employer and employee representative, neither side is required to make a concession, that this is a mandatory subject for bargaining, and that the that is what we believe is the appropriate place for this issue to be settled. This goes beyond, for instance, what the constitutionally required in any procedural due process rights for an employee. If the statute were to do anything, it might outline the minimum due process rights and then leave to the bargaining table anything they're going to get over and above that through the collective bargaining process. Does this, Don, do these amendments deal with the arbitration?
Mr. Chair, maybe I ask the wrong question of Don. When I ask, is this bargainable, you said no. Or maybe I asked the question wrong, because I hear him saying it's a mandatory issue of bargaining. Could you clarify that? Because I'm getting confused.
Don Satchel, OEA. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Johnson, it currently is a bargainable item. If this passed, this would be the floor.
Oh,
anything
okay.
That was
okay, fine. I just asked
this
the question
was not
the
would not
way.
Be bargainable
okay,
whether
fine.
It is
now
or
I
not.
Understand.
It would be.
Okay.
Excuse me for
misunderstanding. It wasn't your fault. It was my way of asking the question.
That's my point, Mr. Chairman. You're giving him in statute a substantial chunk of what they bargain over, which simply means they don't have to worry about bargaining it. They simply go on to other benefits that they try to bargain. And it's unfair to the public employer to have a statute by the state of Oregon tell them they're going to submit to good faith bargaining and then have the legislature continually come around the corner and grant benefits through statute that appropriately should be dealt with at the bargaining table. If you want to be helpful to employer-employee relationships for classified school employees, then you might set out some minimum due process requirements, which meet Tupper and Hammer and some of the case law provisions, and not go beyond that.
What are the areas you see in this that would be you would consider standard going and that are common practice, and what are the areas that you see expand beyond what you believe the rights of the employee are?
If you're going to go to, Mr. Chairman, if you're going to go simply to the due process rights, they have right to notice the charges, they have right to notice that a sanction is being contemplated, they have the right to opportunity to meet informally with a person who can effectively, can actually or effectively recommend discipline or dismissal prior to the action.
This is already...
And they have the right to representation.
These are already in place as a matter of law.
It's our understanding that if you don't give them those due process rights, they've got a case against you for their dismissal. Those are not spelled out in our statute currently. And I think it's spelled out in our statute, I think, is what's in sub 3, the old, what's the what's current the sub 2 in 9 and 10 of the Hannon Gross bill. What I'm saying is, it would make a lot more sense to simply deal with the due process rights rather than go beyond that and place in statute those issues that are bargainable. We would strongly oppose anything that mandates an arbitration process, because that's clear under that bargaining statute that that's bargainable. And it's clear under the bargaining statute that neither side is required to make a concession. And what you're doing here is essentially, by statute, bargaining into all classified employee contracts an arbitration provision.
Let me ask you a couple questions. I think you ought to be able to respond, Chris. If not, the others can pitch in. If the school board now, apparently through the existing process, an employee who has suffered a sanction of one kind in this category can, I guess, request the school board to review their case. Is that what if they disagree with what the school board's done? Is there any remedy now?
Sure.
What's that?
EEOC or any of the other procedures that anybody else has, or if they think that their due process rights were violated, they got a constitutional case.
They have to go into court, right. Basically.
That's right.
Hire a lawyer and do all that jazz.
Which some of our schools are finding is cheaper than arbitration.
Let me, how many employees in this category who would be affected by this change, how many are, and a rough figure would be fine, how many are represented by a collective bargaining unit? Half or two-thirds?
I would say well over half, because the large districts all have bargaining.
Because, of course, when we consider law, we recognize that collective bargaining exists for a lot of employees who may be represented, but there may be a significant number of employees who are not represented, who don't have that opportunity to bargain for what may be, you know, minimum standards of due process. I don't know if the other gentlemen can respond to that question as to how many people are not represented. Mr. Donnelly, can you ballpark it? Or?
Mr. Chair, they tend to know how many districts, but not necessarily how many people.
Well, districts would be fine. However, you can try to quantify it. Thank you, Representative. Mr. Donnelly, can you take a crack at it?
Mr. Chairman, Jerry Donnelly from the OSCA. I really have a lot of trouble with trying to pinpoint the number. If I had a rough number of the total number of classified employees in the state, I might be able to calculate it some way, but I'm really not sure that. Between the three organizations that are supporting these bills, we represent approximately 20,000 classified employees in the state. But I'm not certain, and about, I would say, probably 160 school districts of the 290 or whatever school districts there are in the state.
309.
So that somewhere between a third and one half of the school districts
are not represented.
Are not represented, and these may be, but we understand that most of the larger school districts are represented.
That's true. I would point out that in spite of the fact that they're represented, one of the problems that the employee groups run into frequently is that the employers and the school board say that there is no need for the school board to agree to any provision regarding dismissal or demotion because of the fact that the employee's rights are protected by law. And that is the school board's association's general response when we are dealing with this issue. They tend to say that they don't need anything in collective bargaining agreement because it exists in the law, and then when we attempt to deal with the law, we're told that we don't need anything because it exists in collective bargaining. So it's got to be one way or the other, and I think that the appropriate way of dealing with this issue is through the mechanism of the just cause to cover all classified employees in all districts.
Okay, Mr. Dudley, it's your turn.
The job of the labor organization is to bargain hard at the table, and they ought to do that. The problem, we have a different kind of bargaining in small districts than we have in large districts, and applies to all units, not just classified, because there's a different mental set, and there's a different pressure point, a whole bunch of other things. But the point remains that the legislature in this state in 1973 said collective bargaining is the appropriate way to determine wages, hours, and conditions of employment. the Employment Relations Board has continually said that this is an area that's a mandatory subject for bargaining. The standards that you use in judging those employees is permissive, but the procedural rights are mandatory. And that's where they ought to keep it. They ought to bargain.
Okay, so I guess if we follow your position to its logical conclusion, we could have, assuming that bargaining units were able to reach some agreement, we could have a lot of different standards around the state, depending on the nature of the collective bargaining agreement. There could be a collective bargaining agreement reached at the table in Portland, which provided all the standards here. And there could be another collective bargaining agreement reached in Beaverton that only had the minimal due process standards that you outlined. And so we could have, under the existing system, is really for 309 different school districts, we could have 309 different standards for what a classified employee's rights if they're being considered for discharge or demotion.
Correct, Mr. Chairman, and they would be the minimum constitutional due process rights that everyone has. And I think it's appropriate that those be protected and specified. But over and above that, there are 309 separate employers. We don't, and you shouldn't interject yourself in this area that the Employment Relations Board has continually said is a mandatory subject for bargaining.
I think that's pretty clear. Representative Johnson.
I don't know whether you can answer this, Chris, or whether the proponents need to answer it. How do you view the job classification definition? Is that in statute now, or something you devised? I mean, I guess maybe I ought to ask him because a proponent probably should answer.
Jerry Donnelly from the Oregon School Employees Association. This is not currently statutory, and this is something that we did draft ourselves.
Mr. Chairman, part of the problem was if you looked at the other provisions on RIFing, it essentially said strict seniority regardless. They didn't make job classification, so you could have had the bus driver being the secretary in the school. You know, so they have made some concession. They've recognized that different people have different skills, at least, in the proposed statute. And that's a benefit to management to be able to keep qualified people in positions. But I'm saying you don't need a statute to deal with that. You can let local boards deal with that when they have a reduction in force, when they're faced with a situation which is going to mean there are going to be fewer classified employees the following year. And some of those aren't from attrition. Some of those are going to be layoffs. Just at the outset, let me point out that when the reduction in force bill was passed last time on teachers, there's a different type of circumstance. Specifically, under our Fair Dismissal Act, if you literally read the Fair Dismissal Act language, you could not riff a certificated individual unless you went through a fair dismissal hearing. Now, we worked on that reduction of force bill last time, and we reached some accommodation and some agreement with the OEA on the language that ought to be in there, and there was a reason to do that. There was a significant trade-off. We got reduction of force out from under the Tenure Act, and there was a good reason to do that. In the particular situation you've got in front of you with classified employees, we don't have that kind of trade-off. So we don't have the same kind of interest in a statute that puts into Oregon law guidelines for local riffing procedure. I would have some concern with defining what a riff is. I would just say whenever there's a layoff. And I wouldn't put the language that's in there drafted subsection 3 about the reasons for that needed reduction. And I wouldn't simply refer to 342.663.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Gold.
Again, to kind of facilitate this matter, I would suggest following the same procedure as we did with 2014 a few minutes ago, which is I guess to formalize it, and I don't mean to cut off debate or questions or anything, but I know our agenda is such that we've got time problems.
Okay.
I would move the adoption of the amendments proposed this morning to 2933, in the vein that it gives us an amended vehicle to discuss, and I would hope that we could place that back on Friday, as you have tentatively placed 2014 back on Friday.
Okay, I will treat that as I think it was intended, a motion. Representative Gold moves that for purposes of having a discussion vehicle and a discussion draft, we adopt the proposed amendments to 2933, reserving further action until the next work session on the concept presented through the reduction of force provisions as it relates to the employees who would be affected under the provisions of the amendments. Mm-hmm. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection to those amendments being incorporated in 2933 for purposes of discussion draft? Okay. They are adopted, and we will. I've asked our council to run both sets of amendments by legislative council so they can make the appropriate style and structure changes that they usually do, and we'll have those back with us when we schedule these for further work session. Okay, it's within those three. We had another bill that I think, though no one maybe feels comfortable about it entirely, I think is kind of a moot issue at this point. And the chair is going to be moving to table House Bill 2017.
Is that a motion?
Yes, the chair would so move. Is there any, actually it's a non-debatable motion. That provides community college employees to be dismissed only for just cause. Is there any objection? It's tabled.
You want some more?
We may get to that. Okay, let's, we're calling some of the major figures in 2313. We'll take that up in just a bit after we're assured everyone is here. Why don't we go ahead and get into 2479 and 2701. 2479 and 2701. Revises basis for determination of PERS disability and increases life insurance amount for public officers and firefighters. Again, we've got about 27 minutes before floor session, and I want to try to get at least to the two I've just mentioned, 2313, and hopefully a little bit further in the agenda before we reach that 10:15 point. Yes, Representative Lee.
Are we? It's my impression we're further along with 2701 than we are with 24.
Say again.
It's my impression we're further along with 2701 than we are with 2479.
Well, that's fine. Why don't we go ahead with 2701 first? We've got Randy Brown, Kirk Berger, and Tom Whalen. Let's take the two proponents, Randy Brown and Tom Whalen. Why don't you folks come forward and tell us where we are in 2701?
Tom Whalen, Oregon State Firefighters Council. For the sake of brevity, I won't go through my whole testimony. What this does is increases the state-mandated $10,000 life insurance for accidental death for firefighters from $10,000 to $25,000. $25,000 brings it just about exactly current, according to the purchasing power it's lost due to the increase in the consumer price index over the last 10 or 11 years. We were exploring the possibility at the last time this bill was heard of limiting the lingering period such as it is from 365 days after the accident to 180 days in hopes that that would wash out any increase in premiums. Apparently, the committee administrator has received information from through legislative fiscal that is not going to have that hopefully happy effect. And we're left with an increase in those premiums. I don't recall what they were. It should be in your packet there. But that gets us back to our original position where our that $10,000 in 1971 or 73 monies is now only worth $4,000. And that in hitting that with a full increase in the consumer price index since 1971 or 3, I don't recall, would now require $25,000 to provide the same coverage. That basically was our case, and the situation hasn't changed too much.
Okay, I do want to refer members to the fiscal impact statement.
You don't have a copy of that.
Maybe in the bill file, or hopefully it's in the bill file. Mm-hmm. Provided by the committee. Is it, let me ask you, Mr. Whelan, have you had a chance to see the fiscal impact statement?
I saw it about 2 months ago when we last heard the bill. I think it was several hundred thousand. I don't exactly recall what it was.
Okay, the figures assume an increase in premium charge of $1.05 per covered employee per month. And given those variables, they estimate the increase in premiums for Department of State Police and Corrections Division, and there's 1,626 covered employees. That's about $41,000 for 8385. For participating cities, counties, and districts, there are 3,650 covered employees. That's $91,000 in 8385. And increase in premiums for non-participating cities, counties, and districts, and there are 9,200 eligible employees there. $233,000. So we're talking about something in the range of about $360,000 in 83-85, and a figure close to that also for 85-87.
Is this referred to wage and
No.
No, it's not.
How come?
I think at the time it was submitted, we didn't have any cost figures on it.
I think it'd be mandated.
Well, I would be glad to confer with the Speaker's office. I'm not sure in these circumstances that it's necessary that there be a Ways and Means referral, but that's an issue I would be glad to discuss with the Speaker's office.
Well, usually when you get in that kind of money, you don't pay usually to it. I mean, they haven't passed. I'm not against what they're trying to do. I mean, that's
sure.
The point.
Sure.
No kind of run into something on the floor when we do get it out there.
Representative Brigiotti, if I recall that correctly, I didn't get the figure for the state programs, but I believe it was the lower of the three that you referred to. The cost would fall on fire districts, fall on fire districts and municipal fire departments. The bulk of it, I believe.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Lake.
If you would be amenable. To a motion that would include into it your consultation with the Speaker and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means if the Speaker sees appropriate, I would make such a motion with moving the bill to the floor with a two pass.
Before we go to that, I'd like to hear whether our opponents and what they have to say.
Okay, we'll just hold that motion for a moment because I think Mr. Berger asked for an opportunity to testify.
Does this gentleman have anything to say?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Identify yourself and any additional comments you have, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Randy Brown with the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. A couple of incidents here. I didn't have written testimony at the last meeting, and I won't go through what I brought today except for a couple of points. Some of the volunteer fire districts have increased on their own. The $10,000 requirement now of $5,000 or $10,000, such as Marion County Fire District 1, the district that I'm related with. So we have actually $20,000 worth of coverage, and I can't give you an exact figure of how many have increased the coverage for their personnel on their own. The other thing is, we all carry life insurance, and whether we upgrade it yearly or every 5 years to keep current with inflation. That's what we're looking at to do with this bill here. It hasn't been increased for 10 or 12 years, however you look at it, and we're basically asking to apply some maintenance to this bill to bring it up what its value was back in 1971. Something that Mr. Berger brought up at the last hearing was that this is basically a bargainable item that possibly could be for the career firefighters, but the volunteers of this state do not bargain for benefits and those things with their districts.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Do not the when you people are you're saying the volunteers are there exclusively volunteer systems that don't have full-time people?
That's correct. There's a few volunteer departments in this state that are mixed. My department is one. We have a few paid people that are around to provide coverage during the day. We provide coverage at night and on weekends. The rest, I would say there's probably a dozen or so departments that are mixed in that capacity. The rest of the volunteers in this state or the departments are totally volunteer. That aren't
the rest,
either
how many
fully.
Are there out there? How many are there out there, would you say, when you say the rest? 100, 10?
I believe the figure that the OVFA uses, there's 320 volunteer departments in this state, and probably 12 of those are mixed. So you have over 300 volunteer departments in this state that are strictly that capacity.
Isn't there some federal benefit program you're under already at the moment as well?
I think we just, Tom Whalen, when I say Firefighters Council, we discussed that at the last hearing. That's correct. There is. I sent back for a copy of that plan, read that plan. This was 2 months ago. I'm sorry, I'm not better prepared for the hearing. But that plan is $50,000 for accidental death.
Okay.
I think the representative from the Oregon Fire Boards Association discussed that, and the problem with that plan is there's no assurance it's going to be here from one day to the next. The Reagan administration has marked that for cutting, and we don't know from 1 month to the next whether it's going to be here.
So how would you feel about, for example, since you people have the right to bargain this, how about if we say that the volunteers exclusively could have the right to a guaranteed benefits that's the average of the state or something like that?
The last part of your question, please.
Say that be a plan that would say that the average of the benefits provided within the state would be mandated to be provided to volunteers.
I hadn't thought of that before, and I really couldn't give you a positive or negative answer to that.
Okay. How would it? One other last question. That is, suppose we put into the bill something that said that sort of triggered this. If the federal program peels out, this would go into effect, say 1 year later or something, because you've got a lot of time for public agencies to budget this money. You can't just load them with it without their knowing that
right. I understand the problems with the budgetary problems with that. The problem I could see is the unscheduled death of a firefighter between the time they've been able to rebudget for that and the time of the expiration of the federal benefits. That's the obvious question that comes to my mind.
If you set the trigger right, you could say that as soon as it was known and the date would be scheduled. Obviously, they're not going to do it on an instant tomorrow it's going to happen basis. I don't think you're having the clout to keep that from happening. Federal system,
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that's what I'm getting at. It doesn't seem that we ought to be adding benefits when you already have a very substantial benefit program that costs local government.
Yeah,
funds that they don't even have.
I think we could be amenable to that transition. The only thing I'm worried about, and that's a good idea, Representative Johnson. The problem is that what happens when those federal benefits are jerked? A firefighter does die before the time his local government's had time to budget for an insurance policy on him. I don't think the cost of that insurance policy at any Well, I'll withdraw that statement. That cost could be substantial.
Because you see, you're talking about substantial amounts of bucks. Mm-hmm. You're talking about roughly $400,000 in cost around the state for just your premium coverage. And it's spread out among a lot of people. It may not be a lot to any of these agencies. It may not be a real problem.
I don't
believe. But we ought to be able to devise a way, and that should be looked at as a trigger mechanism that says if the feds drop out of the system, you get an increase. If they don't, leave it like it is. Would you consider something like that?
I don't see a way of getting around a firefighter losing his protection. It doesn't seem to dovetail with the budgetary process.
And leaving aside was the budget issue, just saying that if the feds drop the coverage, it's mandated that the local government will provide the service, because they can go out the next day and get the coverage. They just got to order it. It isn't like, and just mandate that. What do you think of that approach?
I'd like to consider that.
Okay. It might just save a lot of hassle for everybody if we dealt with it in that way.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're dealing here with people that are public servants that are putting their lives on the line every day, and I don't want to delay on this any further. I think we got to move. It's a small cost to the local governments. I'd like to hear Mr. Berger if he has some objections to the bill, and let's get on with this business.
Okay, Mr. Berger, you're up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kirk Berger, representing the League of Oregon Cities. We oppose the bill as it would apply to any firefighters or police officers who are currently involved in collective bargaining, have the right to bargain collectively over wages, benefits, hours, and working conditions. Life insurance is a obvious fringe benefit that is a obvious mandatory subject to bargaining. We do not believe the bill should apply any employees who are in collective bargaining, and in the interest of time, would refer you to Mr. Dudley's previous very good discussion of the bargaining process and the need to maintain the integrity of that process.
Okay, but let me lift back up a minute. This is already state policy.
We have the $10,000 floor. We're not asking to take that away.
Okay, but I mean, as far as the issue as to whether or not the state is going to say what's the minimum standard. The state has already spoken and said we're going to require $10,000.
Yeah, Representative Springer did that prior to the collective bargaining law.
Okay.
If we hadn't had one prior to collective bargaining, then we might not have anything at all now except what comes about as a result of bargaining. So in terms of putting the issues in perspective, the insurance came before collective bargaining, and we have not sought to remove that.
Okay, so I just want to appreciate that clarification. It's not like we're... It's a little bit distinguishable from 2014 and 2933, the issues to which Mr. Dudley spoke earlier. Representative Johnson.
How would you respond to my proposal to Mr. Whalen that we establish a trigger mechanism that would deal with mandating an increase in coverage in the event that the federal program does not continue?
Well, I think it makes some sense. Would fall back to our position that we would not propose any legislative changes in benefits for employees who are subject to collective bargaining over this issue, because it is a mandatory subject to bargaining.
One of the things that goes with that, Kirk, that gives me some concern is that the volunteer firefighters, I don't know whether we can distinguish effectively in the statutes and provide a benefit for them that we wouldn't provide for those who are full-time people, and that in my mind it creates a problem of providing, granted they can bargain that across the way downtown for this area, but the volunteers who don't have a position to bargain anything are left without the option of getting an increase. I don't know how to deal with that legislatively.
Well, I don't know. I would assume that the legislature could distinguish between benefits for those who choose to negotiate their benefits and those who have not chosen to you know, I leave that to the decision of the legislature, but
I just find it politically it's almost impossible to deal with the issue of we're going to provide guaranteed benefits of X dollars for volunteers, and we're going to leave the rest of the people hanging out there on their own and get your own best deal. And that's the political realities of the thing, and it's one I feel is almost impossible to deal with. So in recognition of that, it looks to me like we ought to look toward, my preference would be the trigger mechanism and try to, and I think that can be done. I don't have any problem with trying to deal with that. It would be my intent to propose that legislation be drafted and inserted in this bill.
Okay, anyone else who, let me ask, are there any further questions, Mr. Berger, first?
I think I would, at this point, I would ask, Mr. Chairman, that unless they're in the interest of saving the legislative time, it would be my intention to ask that this approach be seriously considered, and I think there's some interest on both sides in developing that. It would be my intent that we ask that this bill should be set over with so that can be drafted and put in place, because it would be, I would, if that is not the wishes of the committee, I would intend to file a minority report to try to bring it before the body in that form.
Friday.
Well,
and that's just try to save time, because I think it's a good rational approach.
I hope everybody brings a sleeping bag Friday evening, because if it's the committee can't act today or can't act on some issues, I don't have any problem with scheduling night hearings until we finish the committee's business. And I say that as a reminder to people who are proposing amendments who come before us as members of the public. I think it's incumbent upon those individuals to share their amendments with members of the committee as early as possible. Yeah. And to the extent the members of the committee anticipate amendments that have somewhat of a substantial effect upon the bills, I think it's incumbent upon those members to share those ideas with members of the committee and council. And we on the committee will try to fulfill our responsibility in being as prepared as possible when we come to committee hearing and work session. We're at that point where carrying bills over means that the bills are not going to go anywhere this session, and I'll put it that blunt, because we can't carry everything over.
We ask staff to prepare that, and then we'll just go ahead.
Well, let me ask Representative Leek his pleasure. He had earlier placed a motion. Representative Leek.
Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to, you know, go into a Friday afternoon hearing if it's necessary. You know, we just got to take action on these bills. If it's Representative Johnson's desire to complete action on this, and the
I'm
other bills
trying
we talked
to
about
be just a matter of getting
on Friday, that's agreeable to me. But I want to get them out of the way before the end of the week.
To deal with that.
Well, I haven't had a chance to speak individually with members as to Friday afternoon and Friday evening was a jest, but I'm afraid they're probably, without further notice, it is going to be difficult to expect members to carry over till Friday afternoon.
Can we get into that?
Okay, 2701, Representative Leek, do I understand you've withdrawn your motion on that?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, 2701 will be carried over. Okay. 2479 was, we talked about trying to get to that. I'm afraid that given the 6 or 7 minutes that we have, we're not going to be able to. However, we do have 2313 that was originally at the top of our agenda, and we deferred it at the end so that the members who had asked to be present could be present. It's my understanding that the parties that were originally at odds on this have reached some agreement and some amended version. If the participants in that discussion, members of the committee and otherwise, can inform me what their agreement is and outline it. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shipwreck and I met with all of the affected parties, the Insurance Commissioner, the Secretary of State's office, Mr. Bill Gary of the Attorney AG's office, and Mr. Ralph Faulkner. We came to, I believe, an understanding of what the Secretaries of State's responsibilities actually are, and there may have been some misunderstanding about that. I really believe that was the reason. There's a proposed change from the bill, the Hannon Gross Secretary of State's 5383 bill, with about four words, as I recall, that need to be changed. to make it acceptable. I won't go in the interest of time. I won't go into the details of it. I think we all understand what at least Representative Shipwreck and I came away understanding what the role of each would be. And I think in my mind there won't really be any problem with it. I think the substance in just one sentence was that I think every one of the participants felt or had a perception that the Secretary of State's role was far greater than in reality the Constitution allows. And that, once that was cleared by Mr. Gary, as to what the role of the Secretary of State, which is one of not managing any of the agencies, but only auditing for compliance to the statutes, or in the case of SAFE, the policies set down by the Board of Directors. They don't have any mandates that they can actually enforce. The AG really finally ends up with that if there's a dispute. And so, in my mind, I think it's clear that we can proceed with the bill. Could you give us the words that were proposed?
Members should have a hand-engrossed version of 2313, which is dated 5983. We distributed this morning.
Oh, I just misfiled. Okay.
On line 14 of that engrossed version of the bill, the proposal was to delete the words "to implement" at the end of the line. Delete the words "to implement" and substitute the words "if any, comma, to respond to."
Would you repeat
that? Yes, on line 14 of the 5983 engrossed version of the bill, delete the words "to implement" and substitute "if any, comma, to respond to," so that the sentence refers to measures to be taken and proposed to be taken, if any, to respond to the recommendations of the audit report. In addition, there was a suggestion that the references to affirmative action amendments be deleted, and Representative Leak has been apprised of that proposal. If that proposal were to be adopted, then you would need to eliminate on line 6 the reference to 243.305, eliminate the reference to 279.053 on line 6, and on line 7, eliminate the reference to 659.025. Those three statutes will continue.